All right, we are in Daniel 4 tonight. Now, several of the chapters we have looked at and will be looking at are the ones that are in the children's Bible storybooks. Chapters 3, 4, and 5 and 6 are the ones that we have pictures in our minds and so forth, and we'll be looking perhaps one or two of the pictures you've seen before here tonight. This one is the vision of the great tree. This deals with Nebuchadnezzar's madness, and we'll be looking at that. Understand, it's kind of an interesting thing. You look at chapters 2, 3, and 4 are the education of Nebuchadnezzar. Here you have a pagan king who is, as far as what he's accomplished and so forth, history has demonstrated this, he is one of the greatest kings of antiquity as far as what he was able to accomplish, what he did in the years that he had. And yet we have a standard ruthless pagan king. And we also have something very unique here in this chapter. We have, back in chapter 2, we have a demonstration that Daniel's God, the God of a people that he has just subjugated, is able to do things that his God or gods can't do. Not that they could do anything really, but it's been demonstrated. In chapter 3, with the fiery furnace, we have a clear demonstration that Israel's God is more powerful than Nebuchadnezzar is, that he can overrule Nebuchadnezzar's command. And in each of these things, he makes a decree regarding the God of Israel that grants protections and so on as far as the worship and worshipers of Israel's God. But Nebuchadnezzar himself, even though he may have been perhaps awed, maybe a little humbled along the way, is still very much Nebuchadnezzar. And he has not altered his paganism. He has not altered his exalted view of himself, much of which is earned. You know, it's a fact. We're going to be looking at some of this. A lot of Babylon has been excavated. And as was fairly common in the day, as they deal with literally tens of millions of clay bricks that make up the city of Babylon, an enormous number of them, a majority of them, are stamped with a seal with Nebuchadnezzar's name on it. This is my brick. The things that were made with these bricks are the buildings that I have built. Now, he didn't touch a single brick himself, probably, but you get the idea. This is all of his orchestration, his thought, his idea, his putting it into play and bringing it to pass. He's a man of exalted character, he's a man of exalted ability, and he's also a man of exalted ego. The last time, which was probably at least 15 years earlier, we have the fiery furnace thing. Now, there's no telling how many things have intervened. Remember that Daniel has been basically his chief of staff. Daniel has two jobs. He's the chief of staff and he's head of the wise men. And here we are all these years later and Daniel still holds that position. I suspect very much that Daniel probably held that position the entire reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar ruled for 43 years, which is an extremely long time for an ancient king. We only have, two of Israel's kings that lived that long. Or reigned that long. And also we have something very different here. We have, by the way, Nebuchadnezzar is also the pagan being, regardless of he's the pagan that there is the most about in your Old Testament as an individual. And here in chapter 4, we have something very unusual. This is unique in the scripture. We have a first-hand account of Nebuchadnezzar. It starts in verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king. This is his declaration. Nebuchadnezzar the king, unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell on the earth. Of course, this is standard protocol, whether you're an Assyrian or any of the Babylonian kings. The Assyrian kings approach things from the same way that they, hey, I'm the ruler of the world. He says, peace be multiplied unto you. I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. Now remember, here's a fellow who has a pagan background. He knows very, very little of the God of Israel other than perhaps what he has heard from Daniel. And remember, these are not chums. We're dealing with an absolute monarch that probably has no close friends. He has advisors. He has people that do his bidding. And that's probably about it. But I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. How great are his signs, how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. So he makes this declaration about this God that he has heard about, that he has seen signs of, remarkable things, supernatural things. And now he's going to tell his personal story of not what he saw, but what he experienced. This has all the indications that this is a personal testimony. My personal view is that when we get to the end, I believe that Nebuchadnezzar put his trust in the God of Israel. I know there's a difference of opinion on that among the different writers and so on, but that's my personal view on the matter. Otherwise, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense as far as why is it included here. What was the point? He tells the story, starting in verse 4. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in my house and flourishing in my palace. Here it is, probably about 30 years into his reign. His empire is at its maximum extent. He has completed most of his building programs, and they were extensive. We'll be looking at some pictures of that in just a little bit. And so now he is going to rest on his laurels. He is going to be around for a number of years yet, including the whole situation here. We're going to have at least another 7, and he probably lived for another couple, at least 2 or 3 years after this is all over. So I'm going through these things. I'm enjoying the fruits of my labor at this point. I have worked hard, and now I'm going to enjoy the fruits of my labor. I'm going to look around and admire and enjoy all my accomplishments. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was in mine house and flourishing in my palace. And I saw a dream. Again, like he had in chapter 2. I saw a dream which made me afraid. He was afraid in chapter 2 as well. And the thoughts upon my bed and visions of my head troubled me. Therefore I made a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known unto me the interpretation of the dream. Standard protocols, again, we saw this back in chapter 2. But again, this is many years later. Daniel is not just the head of the wise men, he is the chief of staff. He's basically the prime minister of Babylon, serving under the king. Then came the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, the soothsayers. And I told the dream unto them, but they could not make known unto me the interpretation of this. It's kind of interesting. The word soothsayer, I didn't cover this one earlier in chapter 2. The word soothsayer means literally cut decide. And mentioned that very often they had different things that they would do. Some have said that this is a division of the heavens into different pieces, like the pieces of a pie, and they're going to divide up the heavens and so on. More likely, this is dealing with people that would sacrifice a sheep or a goat and look at its innards, and they would make decisions. They would predict the future based on mostly the liver of an animal. Now, what I really want to know is who came up with this idea. Who thought that this is the way to predict the future? Oh, here we go. We're going to look at the liver of this sacrificed sheep. That's what we're going to, I need to find out what I'm going to do. I'm going to battle and I need to get some plans. I need to have some ideas. I need to have some sort of supernatural revelation. I know we're going to yank the liver out of this sheep. That'll tell me what I'm supposed to do. I have no idea where this came from, but it's something that they did. And I mentioned before that you can go online. You can actually look at, they have unearthed models of livers on how to do this. They had books on how to do this. You know, reading livers 101. They did this kind of thing. Just bizarre. But it's something that they did. But for whatever reason, the wise men were not able to do this. I would suggest that, because we're gonna see the dream, because he tells them the dream. And I would suggest that, now we have the benefit of being able to read the whole story, but even looking at this from the first, if you believe that dreams mean something, and these people very firmly did, I think you could draw a conclusion, well, this perhaps looks like it means this. But it's not a good outcome for the king. And I would say that one of the reasons that the wise men did not give an interpretation or did not offer one is because it was bad news for the king. And you don't necessarily want to give bad news to the king because he might take out his frustrations on the person who was the messenger. So no answer is forthcoming. Verse 8, but at last Daniel came in before me. I mean, if nobody else can do it, Daniel can. He's done it before. And there's indications back in the end of chapter 1 that indicate that there were maybe other times where he was able to do this that aren't recorded in the book. At last Daniel came in before me, whose name was Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. By the way, this is a declaration. He's not necessarily... In our country, we have, especially in previous generations, and even to some extent, depending on where you're from and so on, in the current generation, that there is this Christian-esque background in our culture still. And so if you win someone to Christ, you're sharing the gospel with somebody, they come to know Christ as Savior, generally speaking, what you're doing is you are simply refining their understanding of God. I read an article by a friend of mine this past week. I thought it very interesting. I think it was very perceptive. Whether they will acknowledge it or not, I dare say that many more people believe in God than are indicated by the surveys and so forth. If you are going through a personal trial, maybe you've lost a family member, and you're telling this, word gets around, you're in the lunchroom at work or something like that, and they'll say, well, we're thinking about you. Or they'll say something like that. That's sort of a subtle way of, because why is that helpful? Is your thinking about my difficulties helpful to me? You're not going to do anything about it. There's nothing you can do about it. But you seem to sort of convey some comfort to me if you're telling me that you're thinking about me, or, you know, this it's sort of this conveyance of positive vibes. And, or sometimes they'll say, I'll be praying for you, even if they don't pray. But it's the thing that comes to their minds, because they seem to recognize in the back of their minds that there is a God out there that can convey these things, and this is when we need his intervention on our behalf. So it was an interesting thought, and it creates opportunities for sharing the gospel. If somebody says, I'll be thinking about you. Oh, really? What, in what way? How is that going to help me? And, do you believe that there's some sort of or if somebody dies, that, well, they've gone on to their reward, or they've gone to a better place. How do you know this? How do you know this? We deal with the wishful thinking that there is a God out there who will do something positive with my departed. Now, I mention all that to say that in American culture, people have this, whether they acknowledge it or not, they have sort of this Christian-esque worldview. And if they come to know Christ as Savior, it's for the most part fine-tuning certain thing and adjusting certain things that they've already maybe unwittingly embraced. Nebuchadnezzar is coming from a polytheistic, thoroughly pagan, corrupt, wicked society that has only at the very most conscience of right and wrong restraining them from who knows what. Baal worship is rooted in Babylonian religion. And so if he is indeed trusting in the God of Israel, this does not necessarily mean that all of a sudden, bang, he has a thorough understanding. There's only one God out there. None of the others exist at all. And there, okay, he'll learn that. But in a pagan society where people believe in a multitude of gods, and we get this a little bit in Romans 14, that a lot of these people wrestle with these things as far as it coming to the understanding, the wrestling of the conscience. I'll give you the illustration that Paul uses as far as the offering, eating things offered to idols. Now we know, he says, that an idol is nothing, and that there are no gods that are called gods. There is only one God. He says, we know this to be true. But when he's addressing the Romans, and he also alludes to this in other places, there are people that wrestle with this. People who have a pagan background, who have trusted Christ. And they wrestle with this idea, because am I reverting back to worshiping a God that I, in the back of my mind, still have wrestlings with about whether he's really there or not? And you talk to missionaries that work in pagan societies, and they will tell you that a lot of the superstitions and so on are very slow to wear off. And that very often there's wrestlings with this. If you ask them, you address them, they'll say, yes, I believe this, this is what I've been taught, this is what the Bible has to say. In practice, they wrestle with some of these things. Because it's so thoroughly ingrained in their thinking that it's hard to get rid of it and start afresh. All that going back to Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. We've mentioned that holy gods can be translated holy God. In this particular case, I think it's kind of interesting. I think that the King James should have it holy God, the son of the gods in chapter 3, but this should be the holy God. Because Nebuchadnezzar has received information up to this point. He knows that Daniel worships one God and will not worship another. He knows that his three friends are the same way. And he knows that Daniel has a supernatural ability to do things that the rest of the guys can't do. And he's empowered by the God he worships. Therefore, it should be singular here. So Daniel is called in. And he knows that whatever Daniel is going to do, whatever revelation that Daniel is going to give, number one, it's going to be right because he has access to a God that the rest of them don't have. And number two, he knows from the past that the answer will be correct. That this God can do things that the others can't. And I told him the dream. Verse 9. O Belteshazzar, master of the magicians, because I know the spirit of the holy God is in thee, and no secret troubleth thee. I tell thee the visions of my dream. There's no test here. That I have seen in the interpretation thereof. Thus were the visions of mine head in my bed. I saw and behold a tree. Now, in Iraq, which is where this is taking place, Babylon is about 50 miles south of Baghdad. And if you have any recollections, remember the news when we were there a couple decades ago, and you have date palms all over the place that are 30, 40, maybe 50 feet tall, a really big one. You have a few other trees planted around, but it's a desert country. It's as flat can be in that particular part of the country. It is a desert that gets very, very little rain. It is hot in the summertime. Average daily highs are hotter than Las Vegas. Average daily highs in July and August could be over 110. And record highs go up into the 120s. It's a scorching hot place. And in the wintertime, it can, every year, they have nights that it's below freezing. So you've got this huge, that's going to come into play in something we're going to consider in a little bit. So the weather swings big time seasonally, but it's a hot, dry place. Here we have a tree. A tree is a treasured item over there. And a big, huge tree is very unusual. In that whole region, it's very unusual. The cedars of Lebanon were cut and they carried those things all the way to Baghdad to build things, or all the way to Babylon to build things. They carried these trees, hundreds of miles, these trunks of trees, to build things because there are no trees that big anywhere in the region. Now here we're surrounded by them. And I suppose we're used to, oh yeah, we got these Douglas firs, we got red cedars, we got all this stuff all around here. We can build anything you want. This is one of the reasons all the houses around here are built out of wood, because we had lots of it. During the gold rush and so on, the towns of California, especially San Francisco, burned all the time. And this region here made a fortune exporting lumber because they had to keep rebuilding San Francisco because it burned. But a huge tree would be something of a novelty there in Babylon. It was strong. It grew. The height thereof reached into the heaven, and the sight thereof to the ends of the earth. It was so big that you could see it from virtually anywhere. You know, we can travel quite some distance as long as the sky is clear, and you can see Mount Rainier from all over the place around here. Can you imagine a tree that is so big? It says it reaches to the heavens. Again, it's a dream. We're not necessarily, you know, but the idea that you can see this thing from wherever you go. And the leaves thereof were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and it was meeter food for all. The beasts of the field had shadow under it, a place where, again, shade was a coveted and desired thing. And the fowls of the heaven dwelt in the boughs thereof, and all flesh was fed of it. And I saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, behold, a watcher and a holy one come down from heaven. That's the only place in the scripture where an angelic being is referred to as a watcher. However, there are some writings outside the Bible where angels are referred to by this term. And again, remember that you're dealing with a pagan who is telling this story. We're not dealing with a Jew who is versed in the Old Testament. And so there's a number of references to God and to angels that are unique here and not found elsewhere in the scripture. A watcher and a holy one came down from heaven. He cried aloud and said, hew down the tree. Cut down the tree. Cut off its branches. Shake off his leaves. Scatter the fruit. We're going to thoroughly destroy this thing. Let the beasts get away from under it and the fowls from its branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass or bronze. The phrase here, band, could refer to a chain that's been set up around it so that it's not messed with. Or it could be referring to that we're going to put a band of metal around this thing and hammer it in place to hold the thing together. But the idea is that we're going to preserve this. In the tender grass of the field, and let it be dew, or wet with the dew of heaven, and let his, we switch to personal pronouns. Let his portion be with the beasts and the grass of the earth. All right, can I have the first picture, please? Here we have Nebuchadnezzar, all his finery. Understand the color of the garment, the purple and so on. This is speculative, but this is extremely expensive in the day. And I'm not going to take the time to tell you how they got the dye and so on, but it's pretty... It's another one of those things, who in the world thought of that? It comes from decaying snails. and you had to get a whole big pile of them in order to get some dye. And so it was very, very expensive. But by the way, they have chemically figured out how to reproduce the dye, but they still haven't figured out how to reproduce it from the snails. The Phoenicians figured out how to do this. We can reproduce it chemically. We can't reproduce it naturally, at least as far as from what I've read. Nebuchadnezzar, thriving. He has been king for a number of years. He has built all these wonderful, wonderful things. The tree is cut down. Next picture, please. And we have a stump. A stump that will be preserved. And let his heart, so we're gonna change the metaphor a little bit. Let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him. So we've gone from a tree to a man to an animal. And let seven times pass over him. There is the word seven here, and this is true in the rest of the book of Daniel. The term seven, when it's referring to a period of time, is not definitive. It doesn't say years. It is deduced, and I think most of the commentators said that it is years, and it's the idea, you can chop it up different ways, but all the others seem a little more far-fetched. Years is, would be the standard understanding of what this is all about, because months are too short a period of time to accomplish the things that are talked about here. And later on, it's certainly years when it's dealing with this. So we'll assume at this point that we're dealing with years. Let 7 years pass over him. This is the matter by the decree of the watchers, the demand of the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And he setteth up over it the basest of men. This dream I, Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now thou, O Belteshazzar, declare the interpretation thereof, for as much as all the wise men of Babylon, of my kingdom, are not able to make known unto me the interpretation, but thou art able, for the Spirit of the Holy God is in thee. If this is the dream and this is what he told all the guys, I think the interpretation is pretty straightforward. If you're believing that this is a supernatural thing, which it is, and the pagan interpreters would have deduced as much as well. It's fairly self-explanatory. So Daniel is told this thing. And it says in verse 19, then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, it says, was astonished or speechless or dumbfounded, is probably the best way of saying it, for an hour. We're dealing with a figure of speech. It isn't like, okay, we're going to have 60 minutes go by before he says anything. It's the idea that he was so shocked by what he heard that he was rendered speechless for a period of time. Not long enough so people are kind of drumming their fingers wondering what in the world's going on. It's going to be just for a few moments and you're looking at the face of this guy who's obviously troubled. And the king spake and said unto Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee. And Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, the dream be to them that hate thee, and the interpretation thereof to thine enemies. In other words, it's bad news. This is what you'd want to have happen to your adversaries. And so he'll give the interpretation. The tree that thou sawest, which grew and was strong, whose height reached the heavens, the sight thereof to all the earth, whose leaves were fair, and the fruit thereof much, in it was meat for all, and under it the beasts of the field dwelt, and upon all the branch, upon whose branches the fowls of the heaven had their habitation. It is thou, O king. Thou art great, become strong, for thy greatness is grown, reached unto the heavens, and thy dominion to the ends of the earth. He had conquered all he cared to conquer. I believe in your notes, I'll mention the extent of his empire. We have looked at the extent of this thing. He had conquered what is now Iraq, the western edge of Iran, the eastern edge of Turkey, the land of Armenia, the country of Armenia today, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, parts of what are now Saudi Arabia, as well as at this time he had conquered Egypt. He had not had any setbacks in battle. He had won them all. He is at peace with all around him. They are either paying him tribute or they have marital alliances. His wife was from Elam, which is right next, is part of what is now Iran. And so he is secure. He is fabulously wealthy. He is enormously powerful. And he's living, still administering things, but he is basically living in semi-retirement at this point. And the king has become one of the greatest men of antiquity. And whereas the king, verse 23, saw a watcher and a holy one come down from heaven saying, hew down the tree and destroy it, yet leave the stump of the roots thereof in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass. In the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field till 7 years, I believe, pass over him. This is the interpretation. So he reviews, we're going to have the review, we have the declaration originally, we have a review of the dream, and now we're going to have the interpretation. That they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling place shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make thee eat. Now who's they? Are people doing this to him? No, I believe it's the watchers seem to be the ones behind this. They shall make thee eat grass. The word there is better translated herbage. So it would include grass, but it doesn't have to be exclusively grass. And they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and 7 years shall pass over thee till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will. Whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee. It will be secure. When this is all over, you're going to still be king. After that, thou shalt know that the heavens do rule. Wherefore, we have a little bit of counsel given here by Daniel. Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee. Break off thy sins by righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, if it may be the lengthening of thy tranquility. Now that's the end of Daniel in this chapter. He has this dream. Only Daniel can interpret it, although I think it's pretty straightforward. And Daniel gives him some counsel. By the way, Daniel had been working for him at this time for probably 30 years or thereabouts. So they have a good working relationship. And Daniel is taking some liberties that probably nobody else in the kingdom could by telling him this. But as we'll see, they're not heeded. Nebuchadnezzar is an absolute monarch. He's answerable to no one. He does as he pleases. His level of justice in his kingdom, his dealing with the poor or anybody else, is at his whim. And if I want to build all these things and use slave labor and people are dropping like flies as they're working in that outrageous heat there in the Middle East to make and bake the bricks in the sun so that I can build my project, so be it. There's more. I've conquered a lot of nations. We have people. They are a commodity of which I have a great multitude. Verse 29. At the end of 12 months, a year goes by with the since this dream and the interpretation. By the way, it's in third person here for just a little window. Because Nebuchadnezzar is not going to be in a position to deal with a first-hand account. He's going to be out of his mind. And so here we have, he's walking in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. He is walking on the flat roof of his palace. There were three palaces in the city for Babylon, for Nebuchadnezzar. May I have the next picture, please? Yes. Get an idea. The city was many miles by many miles, and it had a wall around it, and then there was another wall, and then there was another wall. And all the things were built, anything of any consequence was built by Nebuchadnezzar. The walls were built by Nebuchadnezzar. One of the ancient historians said the wall was 320 feet high. And it was wide enough on top so that chariots could pass each other on the road that went on the top of the thing. It's all made out of baked clay bricks. Millions, tens of millions of these things. All hand labor. You look at the blue here. And these are baked with, these are glazed bricks. And this here is the Ishtar Gate that was on the north side of the city of Babylon. There's a number of museums around the world that have reproductions of at least a portion of the Ishtar Gate. There's one at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Aaron and I have seen that one. And this would have been the main entrance for the city for processions and so forth. We have the Ziggurat, which would be the, one of the pagan temples there. There were over 47 temples that Nebuchadnezzar built in the city of Babylon. There was a 400-foot bridge that's, and by the city straddles the Euphrates River. And there was a 400-foot bridge that spanned the river inside the city. So you have this great causeway so that nothing can hinder the two sides of the city from traveling to and from one another. Have you heard of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon? All right, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Almost all the hands went up. Nebuchadnezzar's chief wife was an Elamite. Elam is a country that does this, okay? Has mountains, has some timber and so on. And this is a flat, flat desert plain. And so to make his wife feel less homesick, he built these enormous gardens, and it was high enough so it could be seen outside the city walls. This is probably a rendition of it. And they had a system of pulleys and so on, and we're not exactly sure how it was done, but to draw water up from the Euphrates to water this thing. And it was filled with palm trees and all kinds of other trees that weren't otherwise found in the kingdom that they brought in and planted in this place. This huge little mountain covered with flowers and trees and shrubs. Beautiful, and you look at this, whole thing here. And even though the city is at this point in time, as a city, probably 2,000 years old, it was this was done before Abraham. Babylon goes back to the pre-Abraham days. It's one of the first things they did after, remember we have Babel. And yet, the size of the city, and all the things that you'll see, that you see in the pictures, and some of the things we're going to look at in the next couple of pictures, they were all done during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. He is the one who, in essence, expanded this thing and built it. Next picture, please. This is one of the reproductions of the Ishtar Gate. There was over 500 527 of these little relief things all over the Ishtar Gate and so on. This thing, the gate was 40 feet high, and the walls at least 60 feet high at this. And you had this, we saw it earlier, there's a sort of a hallway that you go down to get to the gate. And there's a great deal, that was done in a lot of ancient fortifications if you had a big enough place to do it. Because if you try to storm the gate, that means that if you're on the inside dealing with the enemy, you can get them from two sides as they're coming in to get to the gate. So it's a great defensive measure. Baked clay bricks. These are all covered with enamel. And how do we know there were 527 of them and what they looked like and so on? Well, some of the ancient historians mentioned how many they were. If I can see the next picture. But we still have some of these things. I took that picture. See the next one. Okay, I took that picture too. Those are at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Those are originals. And they're big. This is about life size. Might be even a little bit bigger than this, but it's close. This is close to life size as it's sitting on there on the screen. And so the whole thing was lined with these. These were symbols of the gods, some of the gods that they worshipped. They represented them, even though we're dealing with, lions were an animal that was found in that region naturally in that day. The other one, can we go back to the other one before? This is a rendition of some kind of a dragon. I mean, it's got feet like, the front feet are like a lion, back feet like a bird of prey. It's got a scaly body, who knows what it was. Make believe, something. Memories of a dinosaur, who knows what it was. dragons are almost universal in folklore, which I think are a carryover from when people remember dinosaurs. He builds this thing. Okay, can I go up to the next one after these? After the two panels? That'll work. Verse 31, as he's boasting about himself, he says in verse 30, the king spake. He's talking to himself. Is this not great Babylon? He's walking around on the palace roof looking at all the things around him, because these were the things that he had accomplished using the hands of other people, certainly, but they were his ideas, and his leadership brought all these things into play, all these things into being. Is this not great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? I did it all, and I did it for me. He's glorying in himself. The height of egotism. While the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken. The kingdom is departed from thee. Instantly, bang. They shall drive thee from men. Thy dwelling place shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make thee eat grass as an oxen. 7 times shall pass over thee until you know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will. In the same hour was the thing fulfilled. Nebuchadnezzar, upon Nebuchadnezzar, and he was driven from men to eat grass as an ox. His body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hairs were grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird claws. This has actually happened to people in modern times. I have a book on my shelf written by a fella. The book was written in the late 50s, I believe. And after World War II, somebody knew he was interested in this kind of thing, and he went to a, back in the day, it's called an asylum, and in England. And there was a person like this. He wouldn't eat with the rest of the people. He spent his days out in the lawns eating the grass. Now, he's not necessarily, you know, chewing it off there. He's grabbing it with his hands and eating it. But he lived on the things he ate outside in the lawns. And he was like that for years. He was a young man in his early 20s. And physically, there were two notable things about him. His fingernails became very coarse and very thick, almost like hooves on the ends of his fingers because of that diet. And the hair of his body became very coarse and long. Now, if you have a fella who is, let's say, he's reasonably unsociable. He is living as an animal. He thinks himself to be an animal. And this is a punishment that God has put upon him, an education, a lesson in education, a 7-year degree in humility. The greatest man on the earth is now living as an animal. He is not living with people. I don't think they just turned him loose and let him run amok. I think they probably, for his own safety, and also probably for political reasons, kept him in certain areas. I'm sure that he was guarded by folks in the not right up next to him or anything, but you know, keeping tabs on him to keep him safe. Again, dealing with the body, he's going to be preserved. And people who have had these kinds of psychological episodes are still able to talk. And are often able to converse. There have actually been people who have thought themselves to be an animal and have been able to maintain some sort of employment. I mean, if you're a logger, you can pretend you're a beaver, I suppose, you know. But there have been people who have been able to maintain a bona fide job. And so if you were to walk up to him and address him and talk to him, he would respond. He might be able to talk back to you. He knows in a sense what's going on. There have been, I mentioned the fellow right after the war. Anybody, I know at least one or two of my guys here. Familiar with the King George III's madness? Anybody familiar with this? Okay, a couple of you. The guy that lost the colonies, Revolutionary War and so on, was an interesting guy. He ruled for about as long as Nebuchadnezzar did. He had a very long reign. A lot of amazing things happened in his reign. Some good things, some outstanding things. But he's most noted for two things: losing the colonies and being crazy. And they used to think it was one thing. They now begin to think that he may have suffered from this. The general thing is called lycanthropy, which means wolfman. If a lot of the cases that somebody thinks they're some sort of a ferocious animal. And there have been murders and serial murders back in the Middle Ages and so on. They were traced back to people who were nutty and thought that they were some sort of a ferocious animal. And that lycanthropy has been used as a blanket term for people who think they're some sort of an animal. Specifically, if somebody thinks they're a cow or a bull, it's called boanthropy. Boanthropy. And so this is Nebuchadnezzar's malady. And here he is out grazing on the North 40. And he does so for 7 years. He's outside. I mentioned what the weather was like. The extremes during the course of the year. He can't be approached. They can't cut his hair. They can't trim his nails. He doesn't deal with any personal grooming or anything. How many of you have seen some of the pictures of particularly in Australia or Tasmania or New Zealand, where a sheep escapes and then they catch it 2, 3, 4 years later and it hasn't been sheared? Have you seen some of those? Yeah. The domestic sheep does not shed his wool naturally like a wild bighorn does. It has to be sheared off. Otherwise it just keeps growing and gets matted. That's, by the way, what dreadlocks and so on are. Basically works out to be the same way. For those who would care to do that kind of thing. So his hair is long, it's matted. That would include his beard. Got this big long beard. He's got the thick coarse body hair because of the diet. He's got hoof-like or claw-like, it says like bird claws. 7 years! Imagine how long and thick and nasty what the guy looked like after 7 years. And he has some consciousness of himself. Because the purpose of this is his humbling. It isn't like all of a sudden he snaps out of it and says, "Boy, that was, you know, I just had lunch 2 hours ago. You know, like, why am I so hungry? What's going on here? What happened to me?" No, there's some consciousness of what's going on because this is a lesson that he is learning. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, again, we're going back to first person, lifted up mine eyes to heaven. You ever notice the animals don't look up? They look out and they look down. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me, and I blessed the Most High. He's learned his lesson. Some people, when they go through trials and tribulations like this, they just grow more and more embittered and angry. And I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that lived forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. And he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven, according to the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say unto him, "What doest thou?" He has learned quite a bit about the God who is. And at the same time, here's the remarkable thing. I would attribute, it doesn't say this, but I would attribute much of this to Daniel.
of what we see in verse 36. At the same time, my reason returned unto me, and for the glory of my kingdom, mine honor and brightness returned unto me, and my counselors and my lords sought unto me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. He goes back to doing what he was doing before. He didn't lose his position as king. And he says in verse 37, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor. He's not just paying tribute. He's worshiping the King of Heaven. All whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase. And this is a decree that Nebuchadnezzar made be published throughout his empire. This isn't something he's telling an advisor. This is not something he's telling Daniel about after the fact. This is for all to know. This is a decree that he has learned his lesson. He has humbled himself. Let me see the next picture. There's another old engraving. Okay, then in the next one, please. But Nebuchadnezzar has learned his lesson. It is an interesting thing, the pride of men. There are very few people presently, very few historically, dedicated, godly Christians in positions of high leadership. Part of it has to go with the fact that when you get to a certain level, the arrogance is just outrageous. Politicians, kings, nobles, it all works the same way. There's a huge amount of arrogance that comes in. They all think they're the smartest person in the room. They all think that they are the person who needs to be in charge. And they're all vying with each other for that position. Here's a man who was there. He was an absolute monarch. He did as he pleased. And what he did was remarkable. He looked around and he saw all the stuff that he did, and he was patting himself on the back. This is what I did. And I did it for me. And yet he has been called down a little bit in chapter 2. He has been called down again in chapter 3. And here he has learned his lesson. He has learned about God in chapter 2. He has learned to some extent the nature of this, of the true God, the God of Israel, in chapter 3. And I believe here he has submitted himself to the God of Israel here in chapter 4. Sometimes I share this with I'll tell a story in just a moment. Sometimes we have to take a beating. And sometimes that hardens us in our rebellion. And sometimes it causes us to yield. I was telling somebody, I'll share the story. I know a man who, because he was mean, his wife left him. That a few months later, his barn was struck by lightning and burned to the ground. And he had collectible cars in the barn, and they all were destroyed. He was visiting his brother later that summer, was in a motorcycle accident, suffered a severe concussion, and had a compound fracture, and was laid up for over a year in a cast from his waist to his toes, and the leg infected, and they had to cut a section out of the cast so they could treat the open wound inside the cast. He had a crop in the field when he had the motorcycle accident. Friends harvested it. His barn had burned down. A friend said, I'll put it in my silo. So they put that all in the friend's silo. The friend went bankrupt and he lost his crop anyway, even after all of that. And while he's laid up, he's at his parents' house. They're looking after him. He's in his mid-20s at this time. And there's nothing he can do. He can't drive. He can't go anywhere. He's stuck at this house. There's no television. He reads 40 years worth of National Geographic. He reads the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. And finally, out of desperation, he picks up the Bible, reads it, and comes to know Christ. This is a fellow who grew up in a Christian home. A fellow who knew better all along and had rebelled against the Lord when he was a teenager and in his 20s.
and he took all those horrible things all in less than a year's time. Took a beating. Took some humbling. Now, that was my father. That was my dad. And some people, it takes a pretty hard thrashing to get their attention. Now, I'm grateful he's 83 years old and he's serving the Lord today. And he'll tell you that story too. But how much better it is to yield ourselves without having to take the beating. But we're grateful out of all. You don't see any other pagans of any status humbling themselves before the Lord anywhere in the Old Testament, and you don't see it in the New either. You don't see it in the New either. Very few, high and mighty, will humble themselves before God. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the testimony of Nebuchadnezzar, a man who had much to praise himself for. But Father, when it was all over, much to praise you for. Father, thank you for your mercy. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.